hopeless, hopeless, okay, hopeless, 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 he's just something.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies.
Join us as we peruse all things Potter.
Hello, and welcome to Wizard Studies. I'm Katie.
And I'm Audrey.
And today will be part two of our deaths episode. So part one, we talked about all the deaths before book seven, and part two is just going to be all the deaths that are in book seven. And again, we'll be talking about the importance to the series and the importance to Harry, if applicable.
So starting off, the first death we see in book seven is Charity Burbage, who dies in late July 1997. Charity was the Muggle Studies professor at Hogwarts, and Voldemort captures her and kills her in front of his followers, kind of just like for shits and giggles. I mean, it's because she's a Muggle Studies professor. And he uses Nagini to kill her. This is all at Malfoy Manor.
I think something with this death in particular is Voldemort kind of, his motives are never really about blood purity. Like, I still don't really understand his motives for everything, because he, like, uses that as almost a facade. Like, I don't think he really cares about blood purity. He just wants wizards to be in power.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so, like, his death is almost like, or this death is almost like a show for his followers. Not so much, like, it hasn't, like, it doesn't really have a purpose other than just, saying, like, haha, let's kill this muggle-loving person because we hate muggles. Even though I really don't think he does that much.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So anyway, yeah, he uses Nagini, and you can tell that Draco and Snape are uncomfortable about this.
I think, like, Charity even, like, pleads with Snape. I don't know if that's just in the movie.
Then the next series of deaths that occur are in the Battle of the Seven Potters.
And Hedwig is one of those, and this occurs on July 27th, 1997. And during the Battle of the Seven Potters, Harry had Hedwig with him on Hagrid's motorbike. I think everybody else just had, like, a stuffed white owl. Is that the case?
Okay, I for sure thought that was a thing, but it's not. I swear I, like, read a version of this book where, like, there were stuffed Hedwigs, and they found out who the real Harry was because of Hedwig. I don't know where this is from. I don't know.
I remember that, too.
I seriously, because I was convinced of this. Like, I started having a fight, I think, with my sister about this. I was like, no, I'm, like,
but they know
dead
because
serious.
He uses Expelliarmus.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I don't know what's wrong. It's a Mandela effect thing, I swear. I, like, went back and, like, reread that part of the seventh book so many times trying to find it. It's nowhere to be found. If anybody can find it, please let me know.
So, anyway, during the Battle of the Seven Potters, Harry has Hedwig. And... Hedwig gets hit with a killing curse that's meant for Harry, and she dies. And this is so tragic. This, like, one line in the book. Anyway, her death is significant because it could signify the loss of Harry's innocence, as he is leaving his childhood home at the time. Even though his childhood home was not, like, a good place, it's the last time. He's leaving Lily's protection. And Hedwig is, like, a big part of his childhood in the wizarding world. I mean, she's, like, her and Hagrid are, like, the first wizarding beings that Harry forms a connection with. And so he's leaving this childhood home for the last time, and that's the start of the endgame for Harry and co, and the start of the real world war.
Another endgame reference that I slipped in the notes. Another thing with Hedwig's death is that, like, Hedwig was always Harry's connection to the wizarding world while he was not in the wizarding mm-hmm. world. And so he, like, really bonded with her.
Yeah.
So that's just extra tragic. But another death that occurs during the Battle of the Seven Potters is Mad-Eye Moody. So he dies on the same day, July 27th, 1997, as Hedwig. I guess it's really the night. So he comes to Privet Drive with the plan of the Seven Potters, kind of as the leader. He wasn't the originator of the plan, because we know that was Mundungus via Snape. Mm. Or Snape via Mundungus, yeah. But he basically, at this point, is the kind of leader of the Order of the Phoenix after Dumbledore died, who was the original leader. He basically takes over... as the leader of the fight for good. And he sacrifices himself in a way by putting Mundungus with him during the fight. because he could kind of tell that, he could kind of foresee that maybe Mundungus was going to chicken out and leave. And so he decided to put him with himself and kind of make him the one that would suffer if Mundungus did, in fact, cower out.
Are you saying that Mad-Eye is a seer?
No, I just think he could tell what was going to happen.
Can the eye also see the future? No, I'm kidding.
Maybe. No, I just think that he kind of, like, I don't think he knew he was going to die.
Yeah.
But I think that he knew he was putting himself in more harm, and he did that on purpose because he didn't want to put anybody else in that position.
He knew Dung was the weak link.
Yeah, and he also knew that Voldemort is probably going to come after him first, and Mundungus kind of knew this too, because he assumed that Voldemort would assume that Harry would be with the most skilled wizard, which is Mad-Eye by far. So Voldemort does exactly what Mad-Eye thought he was going to do, and Mundungus does basically exactly what Mad-Eye thought he was going to do. As soon as people start fighting, Voldemort goes straight for Mad-Eye, and Mundungus, they call him Dung, which is, like, I don't think is weird, but Mundungus apparates right away when he sees Voldemort. He's like, peace, I'm out of here. Like, this is too real for me. And this opens up Mad-Eye for attack. He's very vulnerable, and Voldemort hits him in the face with a killing curse, and he falls off his broom. And Bill and Fleur witness this and are the ones to report back to the rest of the Order of the Phoenix. And Ron immediately goes, like, oh, he could still, like, survive. He's Mad-Eye. And Bill's like, even if he could survive the curse, which is impossible, he fell hundreds of feet,
mm-hmm.
and he would be dead anyways. And as soon as everybody's back at the Burrow, Bill and Lupin start a hunt for Mad-Eye's body, which is unsuccessful because the Death Eaters quickly retrieve his body, and his eye somehow makes its way to Dolores Umbridge, as we know. His death is significant to the series because he kind of proves that anyone can die. No matter how strong you are, no matter how much of a warrior you are, this is war, and everyone can and may die. He's the ultimate soldier, even in his death. Like I said, he basically sacrifices himself. He kind of knew what everybody was going to do. Like I said, he didn't really know what was going to happen, but he knew what other people were going to do. And his death also proves, I think, in a way, how much loyalty and standing and working side by side together means to the good side. Because when he was left all alone is when he died, mm-hmm. but the people who stuck together all survived. And I think it's kind of a symbolic way of proving, like, even if we're undermanned, even if we're underscaled, even if we're working with children in the final war, in the final battle, like, if they stand together, they can accomplish their goals. And the bad side doesn't really take that into account at all. And then the importance to Harry is that him and his friends and everybody of their age really looked up to Mad-Eye as this all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful wizard that always knew what to do and was always going to be alive and be the one to get rid of the bad people. And his death really, really shook everyone by letting them know that this is war and everybody can die. And Ron kind of shows this in the way he fights against it. Like, come on, he's Mad-Eye. He can't die. But he did, and a lot of other people are going to die, too. So personally, this death, like, hit me pretty hard, kind of not in a sad way, but kind of in a, like, kind of like it hits the trio, like, wow, this is real now. Like, Mad-Eye can die, that means anybody can die. And I think that I kind of went through the process that Ron did, like, he's Mad-Eye, what do you mean? He's, like, there's no way he can be dead. He's freaking Mad-Eye Moody, but...
Yeah, I think I was never, like, particularly upset about this death because I don't think I ever really, like, really connected with Mad-Eye as a character. But actually the most recent time I was reading Deathly Hallows, I was really affected by when they go to look for his body and they can't find him. And I think the, like, the not being able to memorialize him properly is the saddest part about it for me.
For sure. So, moving on to Scrimgeour, he's the next death that we hear about in the timeline that we had mocked up. So, he dies on August 1st, 1997, the day of Bill and Fleur's wedding, and the day the coup at the Ministry happens. So he was elected Minister for Magic after Fudge was basically ousted from office because he had a background in law enforcement. It was really tough, and it was time for the Wizarding World to have this tough leader for war. Fudge was not a leader for war. Scrimgeour is a leader for war. He's really not any of the reader's favorite characters at this point, I don't think. He's kind of slimy. He tries to use Harry's fame as a way to gain support from the Wizarding World. He's like, Harry, just, like, show up at the ministry. Like, seeing you walking in and out is going to be great for morale. And Harry is kind of like, what? No, like, I'm not going to pretend I support the ministry when they've been working against me this whole time and not listening to me and not listening to Dumbledore. So he's kind of slimy, kind of not a great guy. He refuses to give the Sword of Gryffindor to Harry, even though he, like, really couldn't because it wasn't in his possession anyways. Side note, I own Scrimgeour's wand. It's a beautiful wand and one of my favorites I've ever seen. It doesn't mean I like him as a character. But I have a newfound respect for him. I feel like I have to because I have his wand. So he was captured and tortured about Harry's whereabouts by Voldemort and his followers, but he never gave up any information. He was always steadfast and fought really hard, and the quote is he put up quite a fight and never gave them any information about Harry's whereabouts, which I think speaks a lot to his character. Like, he may not be our favorite character at this point, but he for sure has character.
All right, so then after that, we hear about Grigorovich's death, which this kind of just placed in the timeline. We just know that it was in 1997. At some point in his life, Grigorovich acquired the Elder Wand, but it was stolen from him one night by a blonde-haired boy, who we know is Grindelwald. And then after looking for him for months, Voldemort tracks the wand to Grigorovich, and he finds him, but he's told that the wand was stolen from him years ago. And so basically Grigorovich is like, I couldn't help you if I wanted to. And in a rage, Voldemort kills him. And that's that. The next death is Bathilda Bagshot. And we know that this occurred before December 24th, 1997, because she was dead by the time that Harry and Hermione go to Godric's Hollow on that date, Christmas Eve. But it had to have happened after her interview with Rita Skeeter. So sometime in the fall of 97, probably maybe early December. So she was killed probably in Godric's Hollow by Death Eaters or Voldemort himself. Her corpse was then used to animate Nagini, which is some, like, crazy dark magic. And then Nagini, as Bathilda's corpse, lures Harry and Hermione into Bathilda's house. And once she, like, confirms that it's Harry, she attacks them. And this is, like, a terrifying scene in the movie. I hate this scene.
Oh, my God.
And then it's also when Harry and Hermione, of course, escape. But it's also when Hermione's curse backfires and breaks Harry's wand. So that's a pretty significant event.
And then the next collection of deaths we have are Ted Tonks, Dirk Cresswell, and Gornuk the Goblin. They kind of all happen simultaneously. So I'm starting with Tonks, Ted Tonks. He was Tonks' dad. It's very... Anyways. And by the way, these deaths happened in March of 1998. 2 months after I was born. So Ted was a Muggle-born, and so this led him into hiding after Voldemort took over the ministry and instituted the Muggle-born register, because that was a way basically just to hunt down Muggle-borns and kill them or throw them in Azkaban. And so at some point on the run, he ran into Dean, Dirk, Gornuk, and Griphook. And then at some point, they were found by a group of snatchers. I guess March of 1998, they were found by a group of snatchers. And Ted, Dirk, and Gornuk all were killed for, like, fighting against the captors, while Griphook and Dean were both captured. So their deaths were reported on Potter Watch, and Tonks and Lupin actually named their child Teddy after the dad, Ted Tonks, but actually both their names were Edward. Yeah.
It's a British
name. So Teddy's real name is not Teddy, it's actually Edward, and his real name isn't even Ted.
It's not Theodore. Edward.
Yeah. So that was kind of crazy to me when I found that out, just because I think it's kind of weird. But yeah. So their child's actually named Edward after Tonks' dad. And then he, like I said, he was killed in the commotion with the Snatchers, along with Dirk and Gornok, and Dean and Griphook were both captured, and they both survived and taken to Malfoy Manor, and then later freed by Harry and company, and Dobby in particular. So Dirk was, he was a ministry worker during his time at Hogwarts. He was part of Slughorn's Slug Club. He was one of his favorites, and he was especially good at gobbledygook, which is goblin language. So he turned that into his future job as head of the Goblin Liaison Office. But well, he was a Muggle born, so he kind of the same thing as Ted Tonks. When the ministry was taken over, he was investigated, and he tried to hide it by creating a fake family tree. But Albert Runcorn, the guy who Harry poses as at the when they infiltrate the Ministry of Magic, is actually the one who found him out as a real Muggle born. We find this out through Arthur Weasley. He kind of fights when he runs into Harry. When he runs into Runcorn, who's actually Harry, at the Ministry of Magic, he says something like, Dirk is four times the wizard that you'll ever be, or twice the wizard you'll ever be. And so while Dirk was being escorted to Azkaban by Dawlish, he was able to somehow get a wand from Dawlish, probably, and stun him and escape. And this is when he went on the run. And like I mentioned earlier, he was also killed in the commotion with the Snatchers when they found his kind of party. And his death was also announced on Potter Watch. And then the last member of this group to die is Gornok the Goblin. So after the ministry was taken over by the Death Eaters and Voldemort, they all tried to meddle a little bit too much in the business at Gringotts, and the goblins were not too happy about this, namely Gornok and Griphook. And so Gornok and Griphook went on the run, and they eventually met up with some wizards, Dean, Dirk, and Ted. And Dirk being able to speak gobbledygook probably helped with the fact that they chose to go on the run with them. But he was also killed by the Snatchers with Dirk and Ted, while Dean and Griphook survived and were brought to Malfoy Manor, as I've said for like the third time.
So then in late March of 1998, Wormtail dies. So this is just after, I guess, probably around the time Dirk and Ted Tonks and them die, because this is at Malfoy Manor when he's in charge of keeping the prisoners. So those are Luna, Ollivander, Harry, and Ron, and Dean. And he comes down after a noise was heard, and the noise was Dobby apparating away with Luna and Ollivander, because they've kind of like created this plan because Dobby comes to save them. And when Wormtail steps foot in the cellar, he gets jumped by Ron and Harry, and Ron whips his wand out of his hand, but Peter starts strangling Harry. And while Peter's hands are around Harry's throat, Harry reminds him that he owes him a life debt, and this is kind of a call out to in Prisoner of Azkaban when Harry saves Peter's life by not letting Sirius or Lupin kill him. So this ends up actually being a good thing for Harry, even though if they had, Peter had died, maybe he never would have gone to Voldemort, and maybe that would have been a good thing. But Peter then starts to hesitate after Harry reminds him of this, and he lets up. And because of this hesitation, the hand that Voldemort gave him, like, notices, and it makes him pay. It strangles Peter's own hand, which Voldemort made for him, strangles Peter. And so it's kind of like Voldemort, like, had control of that all along, which is kind of creepy. And so Harry and Ron try to save him, actually, but they're unsuccessful, and he dies. I mean, they just go on and go save Hermione, but yeah, he's victim to his own silver hand.
Yeah, I think that's a very, like, poetic justice for him.
I think so.
Even though it's kind of jarring.
Yeah. It also feels just so random, like
yeah. Yeah. So the next death that happens in this string of occurrences from leaving Malfoy Manor is Dobby's death. So he also dies in late March of 1998. So while Harry is imprisoned in Malfoy Manor, he starts to panic and will use anything he can to try and escape. This includes the mirror that he has been seeing an eye in, a blue eye, which he describes as, he thinks it's Dumbledore, or that thought has crossed his mind at some point, and he basically just pulls out and is like, we need help. I'm at Malfoy Manor immediately. And the reason he's so panicked is because he can hear Hermione's screams of being tortured above him, which is, like, really heartbreaking. And one of my pet peeves with Deathly Hallows is that I feel like they don't do that part justice, really.
Yeah.
Like, when they get to Shell Cottage, like, Hermione is in bad shape. Like, she takes days to recover, like, mentally and physically from the torture that Bellatrix imposes on her. Where in the movie, it just seems very kind of like, she just carves mudblood into her arm, which I'm sure is traumatizing in itself, but it just doesn't...
Yeah.
Like, it shows Hermione's strength of character that she's able to get over that and still go into war against Bellatrix, basically, again later on. But anyway, so he is actually speaking to Aberforth through the mirror, and Aberforth sends Dobby to help Harry. I don't really know how Aberforth, like, meets Dobby.
Yeah. Did Dobby remain at Hogwarts?
I feel like he must have.
Yeah, and so Aberforth maybe. But I think Aberforth probably was new to send Dobby because Dobby used to serve the Malfoys. So, I mean, there could be protections against operating in.
Or maybe, like, he at some point kind of got in with Dumbledore's army. And so, like, he had been using that or, like, knew about the pathway and Aberforth knew about Dobby. I don't know. Somehow they had met each other and Aberforth sends Dobby because he's an elf, so his magic is different. So he's able to operate out of the cellar when nobody else is. Mm-hmm. So Dobby shows up and is ready to help and operates out with Dean, Ollivander, and Luna. And Ron tells them to go to Shell Cottage for safety. And then him operating is actually what sends Wormtail down to the cellars, which brings about his own death. But when he comes back, Ron and Harry are both up with Hermione, not in the cellar anymore. And so he decides to bring the chandelier crashing down in the middle of everybody as kind of a distraction. And in that distraction, Harry is able to grab the wands that Draco has in his possession, and Ron is able to grab Hermione. During this, when they're all trying to get together and Harry grabs Griphook and they're all trying to get to Dobby to operate away, Bellatrix throws a knife at them and manages to hit Dobby before they operate and dies pretty quickly upon returning to Shell Cottage. Harry decides to dig a grave for him at Shell Cottage. It's a very beautiful setting, they talk about. And he carves the headstone as "Here lies Dobby, a free elf," which is, like, really heartbreaking.
And I think also one of the big things about this is Harry, like, chooses to dig the grave without magic. Kind of, I guess, his mourning process, which is just, I don't know, Dobby's kind of, like, Harry kind of, like, uses him throughout the series, but this shows that he really cares about him.
Yeah. It's, and then through kind of him deciding to dig the grave himself by not using magic, he gains a lot of respect from Griphook, and that leads Griphook to be willing to help him, even though he's still asking for something in return. He talks about that, like, I saw you bury the elf. Like, not very many wizards would do what you just did.
Yeah.
The significance of the series is really not that much. Like, Dobby's death doesn't really change anything in this series, but I think in terms of Harry, it could have just, like, continued to light that fire underneath him, like, giving him more and more innocent people that have died to, like, use as a motivator in the fight. But in general, like, his death doesn't really do much other than it just being sad.
I think the, like, making Griphook open to working with Harry and seeing that Harry's not this elitist wizard is one of the biggest things.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just kind of a sad death.
Yeah. So sad. In the movies especially, just gets me.
So the next one is Bogrod, who died on May 1st, 1998. I didn't realize that this happens the day before the Battle of Hogwarts.
Yeah, because it's at the...
It's so,
Gringotts.
Yeah, and it's, like, not... There's no really time in between, which Anyway, so Bograd is the unfortunate teller that Harry and the trio, disguised as other people, walk up to on the day that they decide to break into Gringotts. And Harry casts the Imperius Curse on him because Bograd is a little suspicious of Bellatrix, which is really Hermione. Have you seen that Tumblr post that's like Emma Watson, or it's Helena Bonham Carter acting as Emma Watson, acting as Hermione, acting as Bellatrix?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's so good, though.
It's amazing. That scene is really well done, I think. So anyway, Bograd is the one that takes them down to the Gringotts vault, and when they go under the thief's downfall, he is woken up from the Imperius Curse, but then Harry uses it immediately on him again. And he stays under the curse while they retrieve the cup, but then by the time they succeed getting the cup, like, the other goblins, or the break-in has been alerted because of the thief's downfall, and now they have to fight their way out. So when they're trying to head past the dragon and to get out, Bograd is still confused by the Imperius Curse. He's kind of like in a weird state, and he gets hit with dragon fire and dies because the dragon is kind of untamed because it's been locked away in the vault of Gringotts, which I think is just terrible. Yeah. Don't think Newt would approve.
Definitely not.
So, I mean, Harry is definitely responsible, or the trio in general are definitely responsible for this death. I guess they, not really for the way he died, because if he didn't die by dragon fire, Voldemort probably would have killed them later that day when he comes to Gringotts and discovers that the Horcrux is gone. But yeah, Harry kind of, this is another one where an innocent life gets caught in the crossfire. And yeah, if we're counting up deaths that Harry caused, I guess we gotta include it.
Yeah. Also, just a side note, throughout all the lists of deaths, Griphook was never listed on it, but they left him behind at Gringotts, so I feel like he, and in the movie they show him dead, but in the books they, like, I found no information about if he actually dies, but I feel like he should have and would have died. Yeah, but I guess it just has never been confirmed.
Which leads us into another unconfirmed death.
Yes. So now is the start of the Battle of Hogwarts deaths. And so just before I get started, before we get any questions about this, we're just going to lay this out there. So Lavender Brown is unconfirmed. Nobody knows whether she is alive or dead. We see her getting attacked by Fenrir Greyback, but Professor Trelawney, I guess, Is this when she starts throwing, like, crystal balls and saves her? Saves her, maybe. But we don't know whether she dies or not. Her death was originally listed on Pottermore as the Battle of Hogwarts date, but in parentheses, like, unconfirmed. Mm-hmm. And so people are like, what do you mean it's unconfirmed, JK? Like, this is your platform to give us information. Like, what do you mean? Do you not know? And then her death date was eventually removed. So she was in a lot of the lists of the dead that I found online, even though her death's not confirmed. I think a lot of people just assume that she's dead.
She also is shown dead in the movies. So I think if lists that we're looking at are conflating the two, whereas I think we try to tend to stick to the books as canon. And then if the movies can help us try to interpret things, great. But not confirmed in the movies. Or not confirmed in the books. So she could either be kind of in this Bill-like state where Bill is the victim of Greyback, who's not transformed. So she probably wouldn't be a werewolf fully. She would have those, like, traits, or she could have died.
Yeah, so just one of the many questions that this series leaves us with. So the first, this is roughly in order. Again, we're not perfect, and a lot more people died at the Battle of Hogwarts than what we have listed here. But so roughly, the first victim that we have in the Battle of Hogwarts is Scabbior. So fun fact, he was a Slytherin when he was at Hogwarts. I don't know if that's surprising to anybody, but he started working as a Snatcher during the Second Wizarding War to make money by turning in Muggleborns, which is just, like,
great
awful.
Guy.
Yeah. So he went into the Battle of Hogwarts with a number of other Snatchers, some of whom were killed by the protection charms that we see cast around Hogwarts. And so this part of the movie actually ends up being pretty accurate. They, like, run into it and they're, like, basically burned. And that's how a lot of the Snatchers die. Scabbior survives that part. But then once Voldemort is able to get the protection down, he runs in with a bunch of the other Snatchers at the front of this battle and starts to duel Neville. And then Neville eventually casts a spell that destroys the bridge leading to Hogwarts, where most of the Snatchers were on. And so he falls to his death.
Fun fact about Scabbior, when I was, like, just, like, researching him, I was Googling Scabbior death. And I typed in Scabbior, and the, like, first thing that came up was Scabbior and Hermione fanfic.
No! Slash,
and then even when I just Googled Scabbior death, I think, or just when I just Googled his name, I think, there were, like, YouTube videos that people had made because he, like, leans into her in the movie and, like, calls her, like, pretty girl or something. I don't even remember. It's some, like, disgusting thing. Like, definitely, like, So that's a thing that I hate.
That's awful. Okay, that's worse than Draco and Hermione.
That is much worse. Yeah. Let's
just
move on from that.
Yeah, that's really disgusting. So, moving on. Crab is, again, kind of roughly the next death. We don't really know minute by minute these deaths, but... So, oh, also, these are all May 2nd of 1998. So, Crab decides to stay in the castle with Draco and Goyle after, I think this is at the point when, like, Voldemort's called out all of his followers or something, or they're all outside, but they stay in the castle because they were already there because they were at school. Mm-hmm. So, he joins Draco and Goyle going to the Room of Requirement because Draco knows that's where Harry is going to go. They try and basically track Harry and take him straight to Voldemort without the whole battle occurring. So they are successful in cornering him in the Room of Requirement, and Harry is just like, oh, haha, you're just, like, doing the Voldemort's duties, like, being lackeys, but Crab actually shoots out a killing curse, which shook Harry is left shook. Like, he is not about this. And so he gets really angry. And then also while this happens, Draco gets mad at Crab and is like, what the heck are you doing? Like, we're supposed to bring him in alive. And Crab yells, you and your dad are finished. So this is kind of the first time we see Crab or Goyle turn against Draco. And in this, he conjures Fiendfire to try and kill the trio, which is a nifty new trick he's picked up from the Carrows, apparently, at Dark Arts lessons, not Defense Against the Dark Arts anymore. And he cannot control this. Like, Fiendfire is one of the things that can destroy Horcrux. Like, this shit is powerful, and Crab can't control it, and he ends up dying from it. Draco and Goyle barely get out alive, and... After his death, Draco really sours on Crab, and even during Cursed Child, he confesses that he was jealous of Harry for the friendship he had with Ron and Hermione because Crab and Goyle were never really his friends.
Also, in the movies, this is Goyle's the one who dies, right? So another little inconsistency.
Yeah. Do you want to know why that happened?
Yes, because wasn't Crab caught with, like, weed on set?
Yeah.
And so they had to, like, kick off the actor who played Crab. And so Goyle, they wanted someone recognizable to die, but they still wanted three people. So they had Blaze.
Yep.
As the third person of, like, Crab. So it was Goyle, Malfoy, and Blaze Zambini. So they wanted someone recognizable to die, so Goyle's the one who dies, and Blaze is the one who gets, like, saved with Draco.
Yep. And then Fred is next. I'm actually surprised that I don't have really much written for this death. I literally have, like, three bullet points. So he was fighting near the Room of Requirement, so this is... right after Harry, Ron, and Hermione leave the Room of Requirement after they destroy the diadem, after Ron and Hermione make out for the first time, they, like, run into Percy and George and Fred fighting Death Eaters. And then there's, like, this moment of silence, and what is the joke that is made about Percy? Pie Thickness runs past, and Percy yells out, like, I'm resigning, minister, yeah. or something, like, fancy meeting you here, minister, and, like, says that he resigned. And so Fred says something that's, like, a joke. He says something like, oh, wow, Purse, that's the first joke I've ever heard you make, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And an explosion happens, presumably from a spell or from the giants crashing into the wall of Hogwarts, and Fred dies. And he dies with a ghost of a laugh on his face. And Percy is distraught.
I know.
He, like, cradles him and... like, he literally has to be dragged away from Fred.
Yeah.
Or with Fred, I guess, because I think they take his body at this point. But it's just so heartbreaking.
It also is, like, the reason Ron gets kind of distracted.
Yeah.
In the
He's
battle.
Like, I want to kill! I want to kill!
Yeah. And it's just, I think it just shows, like, the Weasley's family bond with Percy... coming back to the family and then immediately losing Fred and being showing that emotional of reaction, and then, you know, like, he's never really showed any love for Fred. And then Ron being so angry that he just wants to fight Death Eaters. He forgets the mission that they're on to kill Nagini.
Yeah, I think that I've mentioned this before, like, I think it would be unrealistic for all the Weasleys to make it out of the war alive with how instrumental a part they all played. But just so heartbreaking, like I've said before, why couldn't it have just been Percy? He had his character arc already. He's already come back as a good guy. Like, come on. But, so we mentioned this in the first episode, the kind of Tumblr post that we got this inspiration from. And Fred's, the one that they have listed on this post, is like one of my favorites on the whole list. It says that to show Fred Weasley's death was to show that some deaths you just can't get over and that's okay. I think that that's a very kind of... like, I wouldn't look at his death that way. Like, I would see his purpose basically showing that families will be broken in the war, showing that somebody from the Weasleys had to die. But I think that's very... I think that's a really cool way of looking at it. It shows to kind of the Weasley family. Like, Ron hasn't really gone through a real loss before. Like, Dumbledore kind of, Sirius kind of, but both of those were Harry's people, you know? This is the first death that Ron has to go through, and George especially, and they show that, like... they never really get over it. They just kind of move on, you know? There are some deaths that you just, you can't reach, like, that you're okay with it, but you're able to just move on and still remember them. And we see George do this with continuing on Weasley's Wizard Wheezes and naming his child after George and even marrying Fred's girlfriend.
Angelina, yeah.
Which is, it's, again, kind of weird, but... yeah, I think that's just a very cool way of looking at Fred's death in particular.
Yep. All right, so then we got two big ones here, Lupin and Tonks. So I'm going to kind of go through Lupin first and then Tonks, because I think Lupin did die first. It's not entirely clear. So Lupin was killed by Antonin Dolohoff. I never know how to say his name. In the main courtyard during the first half of the battle. And they had been seen dueling. And we know that Remus is good at dueling, but he wasn't at full strength at the time of the battle because he had been, like, kind of spending months placing protective charms and concealment charms on Tonks and Teddy to protect them, his new little family.
Mm-hmm.
And after, when Harry, like, sees everyone in the Great Hall, his corpse was described as looking peaceful. So it's believed that he was killed with a killing curse or, like, some other curse that killed him instantly. So I guess that's some reprieve. Flitwick later defeats and potentially kills, it's unclear, Dolohoff. And that kind of avenges Remus's death. And he was posthumously awarded an Order of Merlin First Class. And I really like this because it was... he was the first ever werewolf to receive this, and just so much of his life and his death, the fact that he died fighting for good, helped lift the stigma against werewolves in the wizarding world. And I think that's just in a really important part of Remus's character, character plot lines. And I didn't know, I learned that while doing this research, that he received that Order of Merlin First Class, and that makes me really happy. So then I guess I'll go a little bit through how Tonks dies and then talk about their significance, because they kind of go together. So Tonks originally didn't come to Hogwarts for the battle, She decided to stay behind with Teddy, which is what Remus wanted her to do, but she could not stand to fight. She could not stand to not fight when she knew Remus was fighting. She asked Aberforth if he had seen Remus when she arrives at Hogwarts, and he says that Remus was last seen dueling with Dalhoff. So Tonks runs off, and we don't know if she found him before he died. It kind of sounds like she didn't, if he was already dueling with Dalhoff, but maybe she, like, was able to see him one last time. Tonks was killed by Bellatrix in a duel. Bellatrix, of course, is her aunt. The significance in the series for the both of them is that we get another orphan from the Second Wizarding War, as Harry was the one from the First Wizarding War. And so this makes Teddy the next baby that was orphaned because his parents were fighting the good fight against Voldemort. And then to Harry, Lupin's death is really the death of another father figure. I mean, I'm sure he would have loved to have Lupin have a relationship with his kids and such. But also because of their deaths, Harry does get a chance to be to Teddy what Sirius was to him and could have been to him. So he gets to take on this godfather role. And it sounds like he really is successful in this because we learn in the epilogue and in Cursed Child that Teddy is like family to Harry and Ginny and co. And he's going over to dinner all the time. So that's kind of a poetic thing. And JK, every year on the anniversary of the Battle of Hogwarts, although she didn't do it this year, I think, she tweets kind of like apologizing for a death. And in 2016, she tweeted, I'll just read, I guess it's like three tweets, but I'll read them all together. She tweeted, "Once again, it's the anniversary of the Battle of Hogwarts. So as promised, I shall apologize for a death. This year, Remus Lupin. In the interest of total honesty, I'd also like to confess that I didn't decide to kill Lupin until I wrote Order of the Phoenix. Arthur lived, so Lupin had to die. I'm sorry, I didn't enjoy doing it. The only time my editor ever saw me cry was over the fate of Teddy." And then in 2007, she said, "I think one of the most devastating things about war is the children left behind. As happened in the first war when Harry's left behind, I wanted us to see another child left behind, and it made it very poignant that it was their newborn son." So I think we talked about Lupin dying instead of Arthur in the Lupin episode. So that was obviously a choice that JK made. And then the whole, like, poetry of a second orphan, I think it makes a lot of sense because it's not believable that this wouldn't go on to affect the next generation. I think JK is really making a statement here in that, like, war is terrible and it doesn't just affect the people fighting the war. Like, Lupin and Tonks' deaths, like, they served to orphan Teddy, and of course Teddy was able to be raised by Tonks' mother, but, like, his life was changed even though he was just a baby at the time of the war. So the effects of war carry on for generations. And then just my personal thoughts, I guess particularly to Remus, is that he's definitely my favorite Marauder. I think he's a great character. And even though he's my favorite, even though I like him better than Sirius, I don't think his death affected me as much as Sirius's did, because during my first reading, I wasn't that upset by it because we don't see Harry grieve so extensively, right? It's like, okay, Lupin's dead. It's another person in...
He's like Lupin one of many.
Yeah, they're one of many. They all happen in this long... We have an old... basically a whole episode about the Battle of Hogwarts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's obviously heartbreaking that Teddy winds up orphaned, but I like this arc that the series has taken. It feels like it's supposed to happen, so I'm not, like, upset about it. I guess I'm not angry about it, maybe. Maybe I'm upset, but not angry.
Yeah, no, I definitely have pretty much the same feelings as you. Like, I like that somebody was left as an orphan, and I like that kind of the poetic... What adds to the poetic nature of this is that Harry was raised by people who didn't love him, and he was just as much an orphan of war as Teddy, but Teddy still had somebody left, and he was still able to be, like, loved growing up. And Harry was even willing to, like, provide that love for another orphan of war. And I don't know, I kind of like that these deaths happen. Obviously, I mentioned Tonks in that first episode when I talked about my favorite character. She's one of them. Lupin, I don't really have that much of a sentimental attachment to. I don't really know why. He just, like, never, like, hit home for me as a character, and I talked a little bit about that in the Lupin episode. But in general, it just, I don't know, they're sad, but like you said, they're just one of many in this Battle of Hogwarts. They're not given special attention in their death, so it's hard to give them that.
And, like, also just even beyond the Teddy thing, both of them dying makes sense because, like, Lupin, it's the last of the Marauders, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he's always going to be, feel, like, distanced, feel upset and not fully happy again because his best friends are gone. And so, I mean, like, him dying kind of, like, it's the all of Harry's parents and their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Tonks dying, it just feels right because she's such a warrior. Such, like, you know, she trained under Moody. Like, she's a great horror. And it just feels right that she would die in battle.
Yeah. No, I agree. So, moving on. The next death that we hear about is Colin Creevy. He decided to stay and fight in the Battle of Hogwarts, even though he was too young to stay. McGonagall kind of says, like, if you're of age, you can choose to fight. But if you're not of age, like, you need to leave. But Colin decides to stay and fight, which is just... I think he's such an underrated character. Like, we don't see much of him, especially past two. But the movies literally write him out and give him a new character. So, if that tells you anything about how underrated he is... But Harry spots Neville and Oliver Wood carrying his body back into the castle when he's under the invisibility cloak, leaving to go sacrifice himself in the Forbidden Forest. Oliver says, like, oh, Neville, it's okay. I can take this one by myself. And so it leaves Neville alone. And this gives Harry the opportunity to talk with Neville about killing Nagini so that if and when he dies... somebody will be able to carry on and kill Nagini. So there's actually an article in Pottermore about Colin Creevy, and it's entitled Why Colin Creevy's Death Was the Saddest of All. It's kind of a longer read. It starts off just kind of summarizing who Colin is and throughout the series. But there is a little paragraph that says, Colin Creevy's death was devastating not simply because it was the death of someone so young, but because of it was the death of a single pure soul, a character untouched by greed, hate, or cruelty. He remained throughout his time at Hogwarts the same breathless embodiment of joy he was on his first day. Whether it be meeting a celebrity wizard or his brother getting pushed into the Hogwarts lake, everything to Colin was met with such exquisite excitement. And then the top of the article, it says, he was tiny in death. Just... kind of heartbreaking, like, and I'm sure his story is just one of many, too. The amount of kids that stayed after to fight, I'm sure so many kids died.
Yeah.
He's just one that we happen to know the name of and that Harry happens to run into. So, the next death is Snape. So, during the Battle of Hogwarts, Voldemort is trying to figure out why the Elder Wand isn't working for him properly. And through thinking about this, he comes to the conclusion that it's not working for him because the Elder Wand is actually owned by Snape. Because he's really the true master of the Elder Wand because he was the one who defeated the previous master, Dumbledore. Dumbledore seems to outsmart Voldemort at every turn. Even though it didn't go the way that Dumbledore wanted it to, it didn't go so easily for Voldemort. So Voldemort comes to the conclusion that he must kill Snape. And I think something that's very interesting at this point is that Voldemort never finds out that Snape was a traitor. He doesn't kill him because he finds out that Snape was working for the good side. He kills him purely because he wants to own the Elder Wand. He never finds out unless they meet in the afterlife, which I've been seeing some, like, good fan art of, is, like, when Voldemort finally sees Snape in the afterlife after Harry, like, tells him everything, and then he realizes that Snape is a traitor. Voldemort is like, you sneaky little bitch. But yeah, I think that's really interesting, is that his death has nothing to do with Voldemort finding out that he was a traitor. It's just because he thought he was the owner of the Elder Wand. And we even see Voldemort kind of, not remorseful, but almost regretful of having to kill Snape. He's like, he says something along the lines of, like, I wouldn't do it if I didn't have to, basically.
I think does he say, like, you've been a loyal servant or something?
Yeah, something like that.
I think he has more respect for Snape than he does for, like, Lucius, which is really interesting because Snape was the one that was double agenting him the whole time.
Yeah. So he uses, it's another instance in which he uses Nagini to kill somebody. Nagini bites Snape in the neck, not only making him bleed copiously, but also injects her very poisonous venom into his veins. So Harry at this point is watching this all go down. And after Voldemort leaves, he kind of goes over to Snape, and Snape, memories come out of Snape. In the movie, it's tears, which I think is really cool, but I don't think that happens in the books. I think it's just kind of like the memory. Yeah. Kind of like we've seen Dumbledore do it before. And then Harry takes those memories and uses the Pensieve to watch them and learns about Snape's true motives, about Snape's relationship with his mother, and about how he has to die. Mm-hmm. Through Dumbledore, basically, we see Snape's memory of Dumbledore telling Snape that Harry has to die. And he says that famous quote, like, you raised him like a pig for slaughter. So the significance of the series is, in my opinion, this doesn't really change much of the plot. I think Harry at this point was kind of already planning on sacrificing himself. Mm. Because he was still, I think he was planning on going to the forest at midnight no matter what. This just gives his death more purpose, I think.
Yeah.
And maybe motivates him a little bit more. But it does change many things about the past. Like, it may not change too much about the future past Snape's death, but it changes a lot about pre-Snape's death. So it changes everybody's conceptions of Snape. Whether I like it or not, he died doing something very brave and heroic. And it does change some of the motives and some of the things he did throughout Harry's life. But obviously, I don't think it changed all of them by any means, because I am not a Snape supporter. And then obviously, like I mentioned earlier, this piece of information really kind of motivates Harry to sacrifice himself. But at this point, he knows that he's not just sacrificing himself for, like, the people of the Battle of Hogwarts. He's sacrificing himself for the whole entire world, basically. And then the significance to Harry is that he was clearly moved by this act, because he decides to name one of his children after Snape. And it basically changes everything for Harry. And I think it changed a lot of readers' minds as well, this very simple scene. I guess the memories is what changed people's minds.
I think it's the memories.
Yeah. I mean, my whole thing with Snape, and obviously we'll get into it because we're going to have a Snape episode, is that just because, like, maybe he was fighting for the good side doesn't mean he was a good guy.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say on the matter.
Yeah, we'll get into that. Okay, so basically Snape dies. We have the whole kind of, like, intermission of the battle, and Harry kind of dies during that, but he's not obviously not on this list. And then the next character that we see die is Nagini. So after Voldemort believes that he's defeated Harry, he once again thinks himself immortal. And he releases her from her protective cage that she had been in this whole time. She was even still in the cage when she kills Snape, because he just kind of, like, made Snape go into the cage. Like, this isn't in the movies, but basically, Nagini's in this little, like, floating ball. And I think Voldemort does this. I mean, obviously, he's, like, thinks he's won. He's on a high. But he also just doesn't believe that Harry would have, like, told anyone else about the Horcruxes. You know, I think it's part of his weakness that he doesn't believe that, like, people can work together and, like, are stronger together. He doesn't think that Harry would have told anyone. He thinks Harry would have been acting alone with the Horcruxes, or, like, anyone else is just not strong enough to get the final Horcrux. So anyway, Neville then, on Harry's instruction, cuts off Nagini's head during the ensuing battle, once Harry's revealed himself to be alive. And he actually is able to draw the sword out of the sorting hat, because when Neville stands up to Voldemort and has that little, like, short speech and saying, like, we're not going to join you, Voldemort, like, taunts him and forces the hat on Neville's head to be like, oh, well, the only house at Hogwarts now is going to be Slytherin. But then, because Neville has the sorting hat, he's able to draw the sword of Gryffindor, have this great heroic moment, and slice off Nagini's head. And with that, the final Horcrux is killed, and Voldemort is vulnerable.
And drops many panties along the way.
Yeah, Neville, yeah. Who's it? Hannah Abbott?
Yeah. Landlady of the Leaky Cult? Or,
I bet no, she saw Leaky that happen and was like,
through boomsticks. Again, her panty dropped.
Have my babies.
Her panty dropped.
So, just like shouting out to Cursed Child here. In Cursed Child, Albus and Scorpius create a reality where Cedric kills Neville, and which we'll get, I think we'll talk about this on our Cedric episode, but then Neville never gets the chance to kill Nagini, and as a result, Voldemort lives for Voldemort and Valor. So I think this Nagini is obviously a really important death because she was a Horcrux, and without that happening, Voldemort wouldn't be defeated.
Does Crimes of Grindelwald change this death at all for you?
Does
it change the importance of it?
I liked Nagini in Crimes of Grindelwald. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's on the good side in Crimes of Grindelwald. Or, like, kind of. She's not really on side, right? Credence and her aren't really, like...
Yeah.
But, I mean, obviously, I don't know. I think Crimes of Grindelwald, and I don't want to, like, say this as a blanket statement because we don't know where that series is going to go with Nagini, but I think that made me, like, see Nagini... Obviously, we didn't really know she was human before.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it made me see the reason for why she's with Voldemort. He can speak Parseltongue, and, like, I don't think that she was an evil person. I think she was driven to just, like, align herself with him because, like, she didn't have anything... No one else could treat her as a human.
Yeah. Also, like, we don't know how much snake and how much human she is at this point. Like, she could... Like, she is quite possibly, like, all snake. And Nagini, the person or the woman, is no longer there.
Voldemort could be controlling her. Like, we don't know.
Yeah. I just think that I'm intrigued.
Yeah, it definitely complicates.
Yeah.
All right. And then second to last death we have is Bellatrix. So, getting her justice served to her. This is also in the second part of the Battle of Hogwarts. She's the last Death Eater standing, and she was simultaneously battling Luna, Hermione, and Ginny. Which, okay, Luna, Hermione, and Ginny are obviously, they're all kids, essentially. But, I mean, they're some of the, Hermione's the best witch of her age. Like, Ginny mm-hmm. and Luna are both really well trained. Like, they were part of Dumbledore's army. And all three of them are unable to overcome Bellatrix. And I think this just shows how good of a witch Bellatrix is, because we always, like, see her doing cruel things that, like, she's usually, like, tormenting the weak, but this shows that she's pretty skilled.
I think that, on the other hand, it also shows how skilled Luna, Hermione, and Ginny are, that they're able to, like, not die dueling Bellatrix.
Well,
you know?
Didn't Harry protect them, though?
Yes. Curses did keep missing.
Yeah.
But I think it also, like, it's a twofold. Like, you could, like, as we've seen with Fantastic Beasts series, like, adult magic is on another level from kid magic. Like, some of the stuff that Newt has just been able to do, like, in his daily, like, stuff, is stuff that Harry never knew how to do.
Right.
And these three are at least able to stand up to her, even if curses were just slightly missing.
Right. And I guess maybe, like, Harry's, like, love magic, sacrifice magic could have been protecting them from death, but maybe not from other things. Like, none of them do get...
Because,
like,
Harry gets maimed. Harry gets maimed throughout his life.
Right, yeah. So, anyway, Bellatrix finally throws a killing curse at Ginny, and Molly steps in. And Bellatrix kind of, like, laughs at Molly throughout their duel. I mean, she doesn't see her as a worthy opponent. Like, it's this, like, 50-something-year-old woman. I mean, Bellatrix is kind of old, too. But Molly's, like, this motherly figure, and, right, she's going at her. And this gives Molly a chance to strike. And then you got one of the best lines of the series. Not my daughter, you bitch. And I love that it's in all caps in the book. And I love that they kept it in the movie. That's honestly one of my favorite lines. So then she kills Bellatrix, and she doesn't do this little, like, floating away thing. That and Voldemort. Like, I don't know what they were doing with special effects in there. But when Bellatrix dies, Voldemort is distracted. His right-hand woman, his last supporter, is defeated, and he turns to attack Molly. I think Voldemort had been dueling, like, McGonagall.
Kingsley Arthur.
Kingsley McGonagall.
Kingsley, Arthur, somebody else?
Is McGonagall the other one?
Maybe.
It's like three like order members.
Yeah.
And he turns and he tries to attack Molly. And this gives Harry the chance that he needs to step in. So Bellatrix's death is like a direct precursor to Harry and Voldemort's duel. Which brings us to
Lord Voldemort. One of my favorite scenes in all of the books is this scene where Harry and Voldemort are, like, circling each other in the Great Hall, and the sun breaks through the windows, and everybody's watching, and we're all waiting with bated breath for something to happen, and Harry's doing this long monologue about how, like, oh, Tom, like, if you could just be remorseful, like, show a little pity, or blah, blah, blah. But in the book, in the movie, they completely botched this. This whole, like, together! And Harry, like, grabs him, like, they're gonna kiss.
Oh, the flying
jumps off. Yeah, and then their, like, faces become one. And then Voldemort not dying, like, a mortal, dying in this, like flaky way. Just, I don't know. Because I can't even really make the argument that the scene in the book is not cinematic. Because I feel like it is very cinematic.
I think it's, like, really, like, it would just be a beautiful scene.
Yeah. I've heard and could kind of agree with that the Deathly Hallows movies came out of the craze of this whole, like, 3D thing.
Mm.
And a lot of the stuff they incorporated in those two movies were to, like,
the baldy bits.
Pander to 3D. And I think I actually did see one of these movies in 3D, if I'm being honest with you.
I think I might have seen two in 3D.
Yeah.
Which I hate 3D.
Yeah. I think it's a huge disservice and just such a lame, if that's the real reason that they did that, like, I want to slap them in the faces. But anyways, so Voldemort, as Audrey kind of led up to, Voldemort turns away from the three people he was dueling. I think he kind of, like, knocks them aside. Like, he doesn't kill them, but he's, like, he's so angry that magic bursts out of him and they all, like, are no longer an opponent to him anymore. And turns to Molly, but Harry decides then to rip off his cloak to kind of save Molly, I think, in a sense.
Throws a
and,
shield.
Yeah. Charm. Yeah. And it's just kind of the perfect moment for him to, ta-da, I'm not dead. So they start this face-off in the Great Hall, kind of like I was saying, and the sun rises, and Harry's just explaining why people are still alive, why Voldemort's curses and charms aren't working on them, the lineage of the Elder Wand, and how it's really his. And Voldemort is really just kind of like, shut the fuck up, Harry. Like, I don't care about any of this. Like, mm-hmm. I don't care if people love you. I don't care if you love people. I don't care if the wand isn't mine. It's in my hand. This kind of very, like, arrogant way he's lived his entire life ends up being his downfall, which is a surprise to no one, I think. He finally gets fed up and is like, let's get this over with. So he casts the killing curse at Harry as Harry casts Expelliarmus back at him.
Expelliarmus.
And the Elder Wand refuses to kill its real owner, and so Expelliarmus works on the wand, and Harry, like, grabs it out of the air, and Voldemort dies? The curse backfires, yes. Sorry. His own curse backfires on him.
I think that this is, like, one of the biggest issues with the movie, is that they paint it like it's, like, the way the scene is done, it seems like the same thing is happening with their wands as happened, like, in the graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, neither of them are using those wands anymore. That's
yeah.
not the case.
So, like, they can't have the connection.
Afterward, Harry, Ron's like, why didn't it work for him? And Harry explains that it was never his. But, like, they make it seem like it's, like, the thing that happens in 4 and in the Battle of the Seven Potters.
Yeah.
Like, that's not it.
It's not what
it's
happened.
The Elder
yeah.
wand refusing to kill its own owner. Which is important.
Yeah.
It's called Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, just the, basically, both part one and part two of Deathly Hallows is just, like, a waste. Like, none of the movies are really that great, in my opinion, but those, they had such potential, and they split it up into two books, so they didn't have to cut out it, or two movies, so they didn't have to cut out as much, and they just let me down.
Yeah.
End of rant. So, Voldemort dies, and in the book, he dies mortal. Like, his body goes through the aging process. Like, he starts to slowly get older and older and then dies. Mm-hmm. Whereas in, and it's very, I think that's a very important point to show that Voldemort is mortal, not immortal. Body. Yeah, and he's still human. Back. Yeah. And then because he had split his soul into so many pieces, that's why he ends up at Platform 9 3/4 as his kind of, like, baby self that he returned to after he, well, after Harry defeated him?
That's before. That's the part of his soul that's dying.
That's true.
But this is kind of, I think it's kind of the same idea. This is something I read, that his soul, basically, he doesn't get to choose if he's going to be a ghost or go on to the afterlife. His soul is so split that it kind of sounds to me like purgatory. Like, he's in this limbo, and he doesn't, like, he's never going to, like, move on.
Yeah, I could see that.
Basically, it just shows how terrible, like, murder and horcruxes are, I think.
But yeah, and thus ends the Harry Potter saga. Voldemort is dead.
19 years later.
Yeah, and then we jump to 19 years later, and Harry's scar is almost faded. It hasn't bothered him in 19 years. All was well. Until we get to Kershaw. No.
Are you a Ravenclaw who likes to learn things? Or a Hufflepuff who wants to know cool science facts to share with your friends?
Maybe you're a Gryffindor who wants to know whether your favorite superhero show is accurate.
Spoiler alert, The Flash is not accurate.
Or a Slytherin who wants to learn about sneaky things like poisons and finding buried bodies, but, you know, is too smart to do the Googling yourself because you don't want to end up on the FBI's watch list.
Are you concerned about the fact that your favorite Harry Potter characters go to a magic school that doesn't teach them practical skills like basic arithmetic or what an element is?
Did you go to a magic school that didn't teach you practical skills like basic arithmetic or what an element is?
If any of the above applies to you, you should check out our podcast, That's Not How Science Works, hosted by myself and my truly awesome co-host, Nicole.
In our podcast, Caitlin and I discuss the science in different pieces of media, such as movies or TV shows, and dissect whether it's good, bad, or just plain ridiculous. Often, we also have special guests who help us rant about bad science and their areas of expertise.
We release new episodes every other Monday, and you can find us wherever you usually download your podcasts. We like to think of this as a podcast for the science curious. So whether you're a practicing scientist or a wizard who just graduated high school with no practical life skills, we'd love for you to listen in.
You can also find out more by going to our website, thatsnotscience.com, or by looking us up on Twitter, at TNHSWpod. We hope you give us a listen. Now back to your regularly scheduled Potterheads, Katie and Audrey.
So, pop quiz for this episode is, if you could choose one character out of the many that we've listed the past few episodes to come back as a ghost, who would it be and why?
I would choose Mr. Colin Creevy. I think that, so I kind of have issues with people coming back as ghosts anyway. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, they come back and they don't, obviously they don't live a full life, they're not alive. And it's really just kind of, it ends up being more tragic. But with Colin, I think that he seems to make the most of everything. And I think that he really would enjoy coming back as a ghost. I think he's one of the few that, like, wouldn't regret that decision. Because I think he would come back. He wouldn't come back like Myrtle did to, like, haunt someone. He wouldn't come back like the Grey Lady or the Bloody Baron, maybe to, like, punish themselves. Like, Colin would come back and I think he would still attend classes at Hogwarts. And he would form relationships with students. Obviously he wouldn't be as joyful as he was in life, but I think he would still gain a lot. And I think there's a lot of, like, Tumblr posts and stuff out there where he's, like, the new, like, Gryffindor house ghost or, you know, like, he's, like, greeting the first years and like, helping the Muggleborns and stuff. And I just think, I really think that he's someone that, like, I would be happy to see as a ghost.
Yeah. So I kind of went the route of Cedric, kind of like sticking with the young, like innocent people that had so much life left to live. I think that Cedric could almost kind of take on that role that you just described for Colin. Yeah. It might be, I mean, he's a little bit older, and so he might make a better decision. Because, I mean, in the Myrtle episode, we both talked about how basically becoming a ghost is, like, a bad decision.
Yeah.
But I think that he had, like, I think that him coming back as a ghost, I think would help a lot of things. I think it would help Harry. I think he could talk to Harry and be like, listen, like, it's not your fault. I don't blame you. I think that would help Harry move on. I think that he could, I think he still had life left to live and could go back and be a student, just kind of like how you described Colin.
All right, well, that concludes our two-part series here with going through death. Stay tuned for maybe some lighter topics. We're going to talk about Cedric next, so, I mean, that's tragic. But also, I mean, maybe a little bit less tragic than just going through death by death. So go subscribe to us, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, download and listen to our episodes. If you're listening to this in the summer, June to August, we are releasing them every Tuesday. So you get a little bit more of us in your life. Congratulations.
And I apologize. And then you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as Wizard Studies Podcast. And then if you have any suggestions for episodes or pop quiz questions, or if you just want to shoot us an email, that would, we really appreciate it when we get emails. Our email is wizardstudiespodcast@gmail.com.
As always, thank you so much for listening. And remember, just do your best. We'll do the rest.
And learn until our brains all rot.